Well, good morning once again. I've probably said this before, but Thomas, I think, gets a bad rap. If you pay careful attention to the events that unfolded in our reading today, Jesus appears to the disciples who are behind locked doors and reveals himself to them first, and Thomas is not there. Now, we can say a lot just from that. For example, why are the disciples hiding in the first place? Well, most likely, it's because they know that they could be next. If the leader of the movement got the axe, metaphorically, then the next logical step will be his inner circle, if the intention is to put down some kind of dangerous subversive movement, which it has all the markers of being. So they have reason to be afraid. But they're also probably still in a state of shock. I mean, even though Jesus told his disciples many times that he was going to be handed over, he was going to face his death, and then on the third day he will rise again, they didn't get it. And I don't really blame them. Because honestly, except for Jesus, nobody sees that coming. Nobody had that expectation in the first place. The Messiah, when he came, was not supposed to die. He was supposed to make the enemies of Israel die. And there were quite a few potential Messiah movements within about 100 to 150 years on either side of Jesus' life. By strange coincidence, if you heard during the reading from the book of Acts, there were two mentioned right there, Theudas and Judas Gamala, both kind of a potential messianic figure. They both died, and that was it. They stayed dead. Their followers didn't, afterward go, you know what, I think he was the Messiah. Let's keep doing this. And in fact, if you believed in resurrection, which not every Jewish person did, and absolutely zero, quite literally zero, Greco-Roman thinkers in the broader world thought so, resurrection was something that was going to happen kind of at the end of time, or the climax or fulfillment of all history, or something like that. It was something way in the future. So not only do we have just the obvious thing that people, when they die, stay dead, and I'm guessing we've all experienced that, and you also have literally no expectation that Messiah would die and rise from the dead, and then you have these disciples who are probably in danger, at least potentially, they're hiding, some of them watch Jesus die. They really thought he was the Messiah, but his death would indicate otherwise. I'd hide too. I mean, I'd hide in a closet or something, and I wouldn't want to see anybody. I'd want to be left alone. So Jesus appears. You can imagine the surprise. Whatever surprise you imagine, double it maybe. And he shows his disciples his scars, and they're, of course, excited about this. But Thomas isn't there with them, which leads us to another question. Why isn't Thomas with them? In reality, we don't know. But this is where I think we get he gets a bad rap. You kind of get a sense that he's lost all hope. And to be honest, I think that's the natural response. That's what I would expect. I mean, when my grandfather died, I had a cousin who then rushed into the room a few days later and go, "Hey, Grandpa, he's still alive. Are you okay?" I wouldn't believe anybody. So Thomas, for whatever reason, missed that first sighting. I like to think he just doesn't have any hope. Because earlier, while Jesus was still alive, Jesus is dead set on going into Jerusalem and Judea, and his disciples try to stop him. Like, don't you know they're trying to kill you, Jesus? And Jesus, of course, doesn't seem to care about that. In fact, he seems very well aware. And so he then continues on, and all the disciples are freaking out. And it is Thomas who says, well, might as well go and die with him. That sounds like a guy who's pretty committed, which would also strike me as the kind of guy who would take Jesus' death really hard. But anyway, Thomas has rejoined his brothers, and you'd assume sisters. I think they were probably in the room. And Jesus appears again. Now, Thomas, by this point, has also said, look, unless I, like, touch his scars or put my hand in his side, which, first off, ew, that's disgusting. But he says, unless I can, like, actually interact with Jesus' wounds and scars, I will continue not believing. And then Jesus appears, and he offers Thomas what he wanted. And it doesn't seem like Thomas takes him up on that offer either. At least John doesn't describe Thomas as actually touching him. It seems like he doesn't need to. To which he then says, my Lord and my God. The most succinct identification of Jesus, by the way. Which is why, I mean, Thomas gets a bad rap. I think his doubts are well-founded. Very understandable. His disciples hiding, very understandable. That's not what I'm going to focus on for the next few minutes. Because there's another question. Not the disciple, why were the disciples hiding? Not where was Thomas this whole time? But another question has kind of been running through my mind. And that is, why does Jesus still have scars? That seems odd. Like, you would think that the God who raised Jesus from the dead, the all-creator of the universe, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who, through his prophet Moses, led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, you'd think he'd have access to a plastic surgeon or something? You think it would be in his power to kind of, you know, smooth those over for aesthetic reasons? This is also the same guy who cured the blind, stopped people from bleeding, raised the dead in and of himself. Why is he still scarred? Now, I had a professor, Leo Sanchez, when I was at seminary, who made a statement that will probably forever haunt me, which is that everything about Jesus' life is theologically significant. And with that in mind, and the fact that this resurrected Jesus, who can pass through walls apparently, still has scars, we have a little work to do. Now, in order to, I think, get at that, we have to take a step back and ask some other questions. I'm just full of questions this morning. First off, who was the first person to write about this crazy idea that not only was somebody brought back from the dead, but that happened ahead of resurrection with a capital R, when God raises all the dead? Who was the first person to write about that? This may surprise some of you, is actually St. Paul. Paul's writings are the first Christian writings that we have. And he said some things about this idea of resurrection. Curiously, he does not talk much, in fact, the New Testament itself does not talk much about the idea of what happens immediately after you die. New Testament writers aren't all that interested in the immediate life after death. Like, you get this idea that you rest with Jesus and you're in his presence, but that's temporary. And actually, what's coming is big resurrection. And it doesn't just apply to people. Like, creation itself, as the Apostle Paul will say, this is Romans chapter 8, excuse me, creation itself is waiting for this moment. And Paul also says that we will all be changed, assuming he assumes, are those who have been baptized into Jesus. That God will transform our bodies to be like Jesus' body. So what God did for Jesus, he will do for us. And when you look at Jesus after the resurrection, it's a little spooky and eerie. He can apparently go through walls or something like that. I have no explanation for that. But he also makes a very, very concerted effort to indicate that he is still flesh and bones and blood. He eats breakfast with his disciples, a hearty breakfast, a boiled fish. Ugh. I mean, I like fish, but not for breakfast. Come on. Unless it's lox, but whatever. So there's a physicality to it. But that still doesn't get us to why Jesus would have scars. Now, Jesus also says that he is the one who makes all things new. And at the end of the book of Revelation, John, the writer of Revelation, talks about the new heavens and the new earth. And in Greek, there are two ways to say new. There's new in the sense of, like, I bought a new car. I did not have a car, and now I bought a new car. Here's my new car. If that makes sense. Like, it did not exist, now it does, it's new. And then there's another way to say new, which is more like, I had an old car, and I restored it, and now it is made new. It was old, and now it is new. Like when my wife and I, almost a year ago, or roughly a year ago, moved into our house, it was very old, and it smelled old, and it looked old, and nobody wanted it, which is how we were able to buy it. Gotta do what you gotta do. And then we gutted it. We gutted it, and it got a new roof. It got new sewer stuff. It got new flooring. It got new paint. We removed a wall and probably a bunch of other stuff that I've blocked out of my mind, which I know is not healthy, but I have to. I don't want to remember any of that. It was made new. There's a continuity there, a connection with the old. But that connection makes the newness even better. If you take an old classic car, Marty should probably be the one talking about this, I'm not a car guy, but if you take an old classic car and restore it, you make it new in a sense, it's the connection with the classicness of the car that makes its newness so cool, right? Now apply that to a human being. I would be willing to bet that some of your best qualities have some kind of genesis in struggle and suffering. Human beings, when we encounter some kind of suffering, generally have two options. We can either become bitter or we can become better. And when you have gone through it, come out the other side better, that tends to become some defining characteristic about you that is awesome. It's those who have been truly threatened and come out the other side. Those who have suffered with sickness, those who have faced death, those who have faced the really scary traumas and have done the work to get through it and be in an actual better place rather than become consumed by it and it's taken you somewhere else. But actually be in a better place. Those are the people that we tend to respect the most. I'm thinking over the years of the people as a pastor with whom I've worked, like one guy in particular, by now he's probably 40 years sober, and he's awesome. He'd been through it, and he's a very different person from who he was 41-ish years ago. And it's hard not to respect that. Resurrection takes very seriously this idea of redemption. Because that's what I've just been talking about. I just didn't use the word. When those dark moments, those real, serious, scary struggles in our lives are redeemed, like that's a beautiful thing that gets birthed there. That first Easter and every Easter since over the last almost 2,000 years has been a constant work of redemption in Jesus. A constant storytelling of taking the hard stuff, the painful stuff, the traumatic stuff, the scary stuff. And in light of the death of the only innocent, truly human, also Son of God, who goes into his grave taking on all of our contributions, shall we say, to the trauma and to the sadness and scariness of life. And then walking out of his tomb 3 days later, out the other side, and transforming that into something else. Like those of us who have lived in that story, and have God's Spirit living within us in our baptism, we're taking part in that story, that ongoing story of redemption that will one day look to resurrection. I think Jesus retains his scars because those scars are the purest form, the purest example, the purest remnants of purely life-giving love. And if everything we say about resurrection is true, that it is the fulfillment of creation, it is God restoring all things, or to put it in the words of St. John of Revelation, if it is truly God making all things new, then of course that will still stand. Of course those scars would remain. Because they're so integral to the story of resurrection and redemption. Now, for those of us here in that space between, maybe you're in it now. You're confronted with the trauma and the scary and the threats and the suffering and struggle. If you're not now, you either have been or will be. I'm sorry, that's just how life works. But in the afterglow, or probably maybe the better word is aftershock of Easter, and in this Jesus, if we are baptized in Jesus and raised in new life, then we have this promise that our suffering will be redeemed. We do not have a promise of when. We have no promise and probably no idea of what that will look like. But the promise of Good Friday and Easter is that there will come a time, I will promise you that, there will come a time, either soon or in some final day when God raises all of us and makes all things new, where we will look back and go, oh, so that's what that is. Wow. It may not be yet. It might be tomorrow. But I know that I've seen this both in myself and with plenty of other people who have struggled deeply. That God has given them this very rare gift and this rare insight many years, in some cases after the fact, looking back and saying, that's what God is doing. Wow. That is a story of redemption, which is ultimately the story of Easter. Amen.